and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fine Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. For this episode, our subject is actress, writer, and, for the purposes of this discussion, director Elaine May. Born in my hometown of Philadelphia in 1932, May's father was a theater director and actor, leading to May making her stage debut at age three. After spending her childhood touring the country with her father's troupe, she got married at age 16 to an engineer and toy inventor named Marvin May. After they divorced in 1960, May enrolled at the University of Chicago, one of the few colleges that would accept students without a high school diploma. She studied acting there and, as part of the college's theater troupe, met a fellow aspiring actor named Mike Nichols. Eventually, both May and Nichols joined the improv comedy group called the Compass Players. Nichols struggled with improv and later credited May for helping him get better at it. And soon they became such a dominating presence on the stage that they were asked to leave. They formed a comedy duo and in a short time became massively successful critically and financially. Their hip, literate banter, both exquisitely written and improvisational, was unlike anything anyone had seen before. And before long, they appeared on Broadway, TV, and their own comedy albums. Finding it increasingly difficult to keep their act fresh and wanting to pursue other endeavors, Nichols and May parted in 1961. Nichols began directing on Broadway and, of course, film, while May turned to acting and playwriting. She made her film directing debut with 1971's A New Leaf, starring Walter Matthau and May herself in the co-lead. She stayed behind the camera for 1972's The Heartbreak Kid, which co-starred her daughter Jeannie Berlin. May wrote and directed 1976's Mikey and Nikki, starring John Cassavetes and Peter Falk, which was such a troubled production that it kept her from directing another film for over a decade. When May did return, it was to direct Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman in 1987's Ishtar. Ishtar's production woes were so legendary that they eclipsed the film itself, and Ishtar quickly became shorthand for a massive Hollywood flop. May went back to a very successful career screenwriting, even collaborating again with Mike Nichols, but she never directed another film. Or just maybe. Here with me to discuss Ishtar and the directing career of Elaine May is my pal and film fan, Melissa Tomczak. Hi, Melissa.
Hello. I'm so happy to be on.
I am absolutely thrilled to have you here to talk about Elaine May, as I've mentioned on many, many episodes of Fade Out. I use this show as a way to force me to learn about someone's career. You know, if I only have a vague notion of what they've done and I'm like, oh, this is going to make me seek out these films I hadn't seen. And luckily, sort of for our purposes, Elaine May's directorial career is so short that we can kind of go in depth on all the films. I think the Charles Laughton episode that we did on Night of the Hunter, which is just, he only directed one film. I think that's the only other filmography shorter than Elaine May's. And so I'm really excited to talk about, again, all four of these films. But I want to start with you, Melissa, in that I want to find out, how does someone your age become a fan of someone's work who's, her most recent film, Ishtar, is older than you are? So, and it's not like Elaine May's directing films are terribly current. It's like they're not really part of the popular culture. So I'm sort of fascinated, how does someone your age come to become such a fan of hers?
Yeah, it's funny because I think a lot of people get into her through like her and Mike Nichols work together. Maybe they like saw The Graduate and then did a little deep dive into Mike Nichols and everything. Not the case for me. I think, honestly, this is kind of strange, but I watched Mikey and Nikki because when I was at Barnes & Noble and stuff, I would see the cover, like, I would see it at Barnes & Noble all the time in the Criterion section. And I thought the Criterion cover is amazing. And I liked John Cassavetes because I had seen A Woman Under the Influence. And this was probably in high school. So I didn't know a ton about like new Hollywood cinema and stuff at the time. And so I was like, I'm just going to buy this and watch it. And it ended up being incredible. I had no idea that she had a comedy background or anything like that. And then it took me a while before I watched any of her other films. Just, you know, she only has three others. So I watched A New Leaf in college, like my senior year of college, so like 4 or 5 years later. And I watched that for a class, about the 60s and 70s, and I really liked it, but those were the only two I'd seen before agreeing to do this podcast. And when you reached out and you were saying like, oh, maybe we can do a director or whatever. And she was just the first one I thought of because famously Ishtar is such a bomb that and I hadn't seen it before. And I was like, you know, that's a good excuse to watch Ishtar. Because I felt like I was never gonna watch it on my own.
Yeah, why would you? Why have you made
Yeah, but
why
she's
would you say
so
that?
funny. Like she's so incredible. Like Mikey and Nikki on its own, like if even if you had never encountered anything from her, like it Mikey and Nikki is just like an excuse for her to make literally whatever she wants for the rest of her life. In my opinion.
I think like a lot of people, I didn't know up until, I don't know, 10 years ago that Mikey and Nikki was a not a John Cassavetes film, because you assume that it is because he's in it, and Peter Falk is in it, who was in all of John Cassavetes' movies, and it looks like this kind of gritty urban comedy slash drama, and you're like, oh, that I'm like, that's a Cassavetes, and then I'm like, wait, Elaine May directed that? And then I was like, oh, well, that must be a Cassavetes script that she just directed. No, she wrote it too. It's like, wow, this was really her thing from beginning to end. And so can you remember when you saw New Leaf? Because if you're going into seeing New Leaf based on Mikey and Nikki, you got to be like, whoa, wait a minute. The same person made these movies?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was a little bit more prepared just because it was for a class, and before we watched it, my professor talked a little bit about her career and who she is and her relationship to Mike Nichols and everything. And so I knew that it was a comedy, and we were talking about it in the context of dark comedy. I was trying to remember what class. I mean, I watched so many movies for classes. But we were talking about in the context of like both female directors and like dark comedies and stuff. And I don't want to get ahead of myself with a New Leaf, but I remember not loving it that much the first time I watched it. I think I found both of them a little bit annoying. Like both Henry and Henrietta kind of annoying. But this time watching it, for the purposes of this podcast, I enjoyed it a lot more. Like I found her character like really sweet and not annoying. I don't know.
I mean, for me personally, Walter Matthau can do no wrong from about 1965 to around 1982. Every single one of his movies I love, and I love him in them. And so when he shows, even when he's a complete jerk, or like he is in this, I mean, for anyone who hasn't seen the film, he's an ex-rich guy who was burned through all of his money and is a blissful idiot. There's this amazing scene with his lawyer where his lawyer tries to explain, you have no more money. And he's like, well, I'll just write you another check to cover it. He's like, no, you don't understand. You have no more money. And this guy has lived so high off of his money for so long. He's so detached that he doesn't understand. And so he decides to marry a rich woman and live off her. And that ends up being this milquetoast woman played by Elaine May herself. By the way, the only reason Elaine May ended up in the part, even though she was an actress and probably could handle it, was she just wanted to direct. She basically, the studio said, wouldn't approve any of her choices because of the budget. And so she kept saying, there's nobody left for me to, and they'd be like, well, why don't you just do it? And we'll just take it out of your own salary. So she ends up doing it by default.
That's so crazy.
Which is, it may, I mean, you think about, she's directing her first film, right? And for anyone, that's a Herculean task. And then having to star in your movie while you're directing it seems just so terrifying, just like such a Herculean load. And I will tell you, I think the first time I saw it, I didn't love it. It seemed a little off to me, and I couldn't put my finger on it. And then I rewatched it, like you're talking about, for the purposes of this, and I liked it a lot better. So I think it's just one of those movies that you need to sit with it a little, and let it. And of course, that's terrible for box office because most people don't do that.
Right.
They go see it once, and if they don't like it, they don't like it. But it's that kind of movie. I think even with Walter Matthau being a complete shitheel, which I enjoy, that first time I just was like, I'm not laughing at this. And then the second time I was like, oh, now I'm on this movie's rhythm. So it's just that kind of movie.
Yeah, I think that it's interesting that you say that of like there was something off about it because I also feel that and I still felt that the second time. And I think it, you know, I should have done more research into this, but I like ran out of time. But I remember in that class that I took, we were talking about how, you know, the studio, there were just like a lot of script changes from the studio and everything. And she originally was going to have it that like he actually succeeds in killing her and taking her money. And
wow,
which is insane. I mean, I think I even think that maybe I'll look it up, but I even think that they actually filmed that ending and there's like an actual alternative ending that they had. And then the studio saw it and was like, you have to change that. Because like audiences aren't gonna like the fact that our main character killed a woman, or like he lets her drown, I guess. And
which is
I
do brutal, that, right? Dude, that's brutal.
Oh my god, it's insane. And like, and oh my god, not to mention all the funny parts of him just like openly talking about poison and like reading about poisonous plants and stuff in front of her, and she's so oblivious.
Yeah,
but Yeah, I think that there is something almost like sarcastic in the ending in how, again, I guess I'm jumping ahead of myself a little talking about the end, but I feel like there's almost something sarcastic in the end of that, of them literally walking into the sunset when the whole time these two people, like there's no romance between them at all. I don't know. Which I think is kind of brilliant on her part. It's a little bit like, I don't know, to me I was almost expecting him to just let her die the whole time instead of those like cliche things where at the end like, oh, enemies to lovers type of thing where they start by hating each other and then end up together.
I will say I never got a full handle on her character, like whether was she that clueless that she doesn't understand this guy. And again, I have to think it's because she had to step in at the last second. I mean, you think about how much an actor has to prepare for their role, and then she's got to jump in at sort of, you know, with no other choice to go and do this while also directing it. And so that was the part, like, she's very, like, she's like olive oil. She's like a super bookish olive oil kind of thing. but like, you know, Walter Matthau, at that point, he was an experienced actor. Not that she wasn't, but she hadn't really done that much film work to that point. And so it's just, that's the only part of the thing that misses, but I still laugh at it. And I laugh at the situations and all the disappointing actors that she's got. Now, part of the, I'm going to bring up for her films, the troubled production that she had. And the reason I bring this up is because I think it informs each film as they go on, because the more troubled a production you have, I think the more the studio is, you know, waiting to pounce, right? So apparently the original cut of A New Leaf was 3 hours long.
Oh my gosh.
Right? 3 hours long. And she gives it to Paramount, and Paramount is like, well, we're not releasing a 3 hour film. Forget it. And so they take her off of it. They cut 80 minutes out of it. Apparently Walton Matthau does in fact kill two people in the movie.
God.
And they cut all that out. And it got to the point where Elaine May actually sued Paramount to get her name removed as writer and director, but nobody with any power was on her side. And it went all the way to court. The judge of the trial, or maybe not the trial, but the judge, you know, overseeing this case, eventually sides with Paramount, saying their version, their cut of the movie was hilarious and bound to be a hit. I'm like, what is this? Wow. Eileen Cannon? Like, who is this judge that like, that's not your decision to come up with that. I think this cut's hilarious. It's bound to be boffo box. All like, what?
Yeah. It has like nothing to do with the actual like legal case that she's trying to make.
No, like what? Wow. The hell? Like, that's clearly a judge who just was basking in the reflected glory of being involved in like a Hollywood case. I'm like,
Yeah.
If I was Elaine, maybe like, what am I in the upside down? Like, what's happening here? And so she
Yeah,
ends
and
up,
you're
so anyway, she
sorry.
fails and she doesn't get her name taken. But I mean, you're already off to a bad start that if in your first film, you want to sue to take your name off it and it doesn't work, like, oh boy.
Yeah, like it sets this precedent of like of the studio and of her in general, like just not getting what she thinks is like artistically the right choice. I mean, to me, the idea of that film escalating to him killing two people is so funny. Like it's so much funnier than what actually happens in the film. Like I like the film fine, but it's not like the best comedy I've ever seen. But if it was like, maybe if it wasn't 3 hours, but if it was this like more, if it's a thing that escalates so much more, it would be way funnier, I think. I think that she was right. And that judge is stupid.
I tend to find 3-hour cuts of movies to, I generally like them because I feel like for someone to go that far, they have to really have the goods. Now, they could, there's some exceptions, but I find that like a lot of movies that are 2 hours and 20 minutes or 2 hours and 30 minutes are ponderously slow and overlong. But once it hits 3 hours, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm all in. Because
Oh,
it's like
yeah.
you for you to go that far to make, and so as much as I enjoy the cut that exists, I really would love to see a 3 hour for just like what would that even look like? A 3 hour version of this movie. And one other detail about this that I want to mention is I saw this on the Wikipedia page for this movie. In the early 90s, the then head of Paramount Repertory, Michael Schlesinger, asked that the vaults be searched to see if the trims had survived in hopes of restoring May's original cut. Nothing was found. So they
Wow.
got rid of all of it, which is again just tragic that they don't, I mean, they don't think to keep these things. And if I may plug my own show, Michael Schlesinger will be a guest on this show next month. So,
Oh,
totally
wow,
random.
really?
Yes. Not talking about anything related to Elaine May, but it just happened to
Wow.
be. He's booked for next month's show. And when I was doing the research for this month, I'm like, is that the same Michael Schlesinger? And I wrote, he's like, yeah, that was me. So it's
Wow.
just,
You'll
that was
have to talk about that.
too good to pass up. I just could not pass up plugging the show ahead of time. I never, only ever do that.
That's
So
amazing, though.
yeah.
That's crazy.
So now you would think, right, with Elaine's difficulty on her first film, right? That seems to set the stage for what you would think would be disaster, because she's obviously not working well within the studio system if after one film it's already to the point where you're suing Paramount to get your name off it. It's not good. But somehow the very next year she rolls into another film written by Neil Simon, not the only, I think the only film of Neil Simon's, not based on one of his own works. It's written, it was based on a book by another author called The Heartbreak Kid, starring Charles Grodin, Sybil Shepherd. They remade it with Ben Stiller. I've never seen that one. Now, I had never seen The Heartbreak Kid to this point. I had always heard about it. It's very hard to find. Very hard to find on streaming. And I found the reason for that is the reason this film is so difficult to find on streaming and hasn't had a home video release since 2000s is because it fell into the hands of a pharmaceutical company, Bristol Myers Squibb, who dissolved their entertainment division shortly after creating it, leaving this movie's distribution rights in limbo. First of all, why does a pharmaceutical company have a entertainment division? Why is that even a thing? But what an insane thing that a movie could be taken over by a pharmaceutical company and then essentially just get buried. So
Yeah, it's well, I also wanted to say about that is that like it reminds me of what streaming service and production companies are doing now with just like deleting films or removing them from their platforms. Like it's really depressing because people don't a lot of people don't buy physical media anymore. Like the average person doesn't. I mean, I have plenty of movies on DVD, but most people don't do that. And then there's no way for like those things to survive after production companies get rid of them or decide that they're not worth it anymore. And even if there's a film that nobody has bought on Amazon or whatever in like years, that doesn't mean that it's not going to be valuable later. And it reminds me of, I don't know, it just reminds me of that because you can tell it's like this company was just like, oh, well, we're shutting it down. We're not going to bother like making sure that these films, like they could have sold the distribution rights to anywhere
Yep.
and
Yeah.
they just like don't bother.
It's just a number on a sheet, you know. That's all that it's a, it's a, on an Excel spreadsheet. So now I did finally see Heartbreak Kid. It's available on YouTube. Someone posted the whole movie on YouTube, but you got to see it for the first time in probably the most ideal situation for seeing a movie for the first time. So why don't you explain what that was?
Shortly before we had already agreed, like we had already talked about doing this episode, and you sent it to me, I think, but it was somebody had made a had an original scan from a when the film aired on television at some point, and it's a 2K scan. And they finally like restored it enough and put it together enough for it to be played in a movie theater. And they were playing it at Alamo Draft Houses, I guess across the country. I don't know if it was every location, but they were playing it at one of the locations close to me. So I went and saw that at Alamo Draft House, and it was amazing. Like I always prefer to see things in theaters. My theory is always that it makes a film at the bare minimum 30% better. And
I think you've got a number attached to it.
yeah, it's that exact number. Like every average movie that I've seen in the theater instantly becomes 30% better just because I'm seeing it in a theater.
When you saw The Last Waltz, right in the theater,
Yeah,
30% better.
exactly. And I mean, it was interesting because it definitely was 2K, a 2K scan. Like it was not a restoration. It was, you could tell it was just a scan. There was hissing in the background with the sound, but that wasn't really like that didn't really bother me. The image looked pretty good. It was a little bit grainy in some parts, but it wasn't deteriorated really bad. And so it was great. I paid $8 for Coca-Cola and
That's it.
And I watched this movie and it was awesome. And yeah, I was really happy I got to do that just because it made me feel like, comedies are always better when you're sitting in a room with people laugh who are laughing as well. And I think if I were to watch it at home, not only would it be easier to be like distracted or whatever,
Sure.
and also I don't know what the version on YouTube looked like, but I don't know if it was, if it's about the same quality or what, but I'm just glad to have seen it, on a big projector screen. And yeah, it was a really good experience. It was nice like laughing along with people, and I don't know, it really adds to the whole thing.
How full was the theater?
It wasn't sold out, but there was like I don't know. There were maybe I was sitting closer to the front, so I didn't see like behind me that much. But there were maybe like 20 other people in there. It was one of
Okay.
their smaller theaters, and it
Okay.
was at like 1 p.m. on a Saturday.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, I think that was the only showing that they were doing too.
I mean, I really love the pure dumb luck of it was because, like you said, we agreed, we talked about doing this, we even set the date. And then we were like, I was like, God, this movie's kind of hard to find. And then I said, oh, it is on YouTube. It's better than nothing. And then right after that, Alamo said, hey, we're screening this.
Yeah,
I was
it's
like, oh
crazy.
my God. And then you, it was, you know, not only screening it, but like screening it close enough that you could go to it. And it was within the time frame of when we found when we saw that announcement and doing this episode. I mean, it was like
Yeah,
of
it
all
was
the
perfect
films for
timing.
them to
Like, I
pick.
don't even think we had to change, like, maybe by like a couple days, but we barely had to change, what day we were recording this. It's
Yep.
awesome.
Yeah, they really did
We're
us a
so
solid.
lucky.
they really did. I think The Heartbreak Kid is like a low-key masterpiece. I
Yeah,
really
okay, I
do.
agree. I agree.
And it seems so counter to what you've because what we're gonna talk about with Mikey and Nikki, and then of course Ishtar is every single one of her movies is a deeply troubled production. Like deeply troubled, except it seems this one. I could not find any stories about this film having a troubled production. I couldn't find any of that stuff. And This movie, again, I haven't seen the remake. I don't have any particular interest in seeing the remake. It doesn't, I'm betting it doesn't have any of the same colors of this one. But this, it stars Charles Grodin, Sybil Shepherd, as I mentioned in the intro. It stars Elaine May's daughter, Jeannie Berlin, as Charles Grodin's wife, who he essentially dumps on her on their honeymoon to pick up with this golden goddess, Sybil Shepherd, at the absolute peak of her beauty, of her, her sort of screen presence. And, just when you hear that premise, right, you think there's no way that movie can work. That's an absurd premise. There's no way that you can possibly like that. That's just stupid. I wouldn't, why I wouldn't want to see that. And yet it works. And it is deeply uncomfortable. Charles Grodin's character is, I'd say, in turns, hilarious, sympathetic, and also probably a sociopath.
Yeah, just the absolute like most horrible man.
Yeah. And I think this film has, and this is going to get into something I want to bring up as a little sidetrack in a moment, but I think this film has one of the best final shots I have ever seen in a movie. And I don't even want to get into details for people who haven't seen it. If again, if you want to watch it, it is on YouTube. I didn't think the picture quality was too bad. But the ending where it just, how can we, it just stays on Charles Grodin. Let's put it that way, right? I don't want to get more specific than that, but it is subtle. And it's the kind of shot that you don't think for a moment would be the final shot of a movie. And like you said, I think if you watch it at home, you might be a little tempted to get up and get yourself a drink while it's running, or for 1 second, look at your phone or pet the dog or whatever. And then the movie's over, and you're like, wait, what did, how did it just end? Hold on. This thing, I honestly think this is like a low key masterpiece that she could pull this off with these actors and be able to tell the story in a way that seems plausible and real, but also gut-levelingly cringy, humor, because you're just so horrified by what you're watching. And Eddie Albert as the dad, he got an Oscar nomination for this. He is
Oh, really?
tremendous.
Wow.
Yeah, he did. He
Yeah,
was
he's amazing.
tremendous in this movie as a guy who sees right through Charles Grodin and just absolutely wants no parts of him in his daughter's life. And he keeps failing to dissuade him from inserting himself in his daughter's life. I look at this and I say, if she had only ever directed this, it would still be, I would still say she deserves to be listed as one of the great comedy directors, because this movie, I'd say, is just almost flawless.
Yeah, I agree. I think one of the interesting things about her filmography as a whole, which I think we can talk about more, like when talking about all of her films together, but is just like all of her films are starring, like they're about male, like the main character is a man. And also like two out of four of her films are about like male friendships and stuff. And so I think it's interesting. It's so fascinating in this film how Charles Grodin's character, Lenny, his name's Lenny, how you can sort of like be on his side at first in terms of like you don't really know him before, but you just see him like meeting his wife, them getting married, and then like she's being a little bit annoying. And so at first I was expecting for it to be just completely annoyed with Lila, with his wife, and just be watching it play out. But I love the way that she slowly, and she does this with other films too, like she slowly kind of like peels back the like masks of these men and like showing how actually horrible they are. And while like the audience maybe at first doesn't realize it, and then slowly you start to realize that he's just like really unfair to her, and she's really sweet, like his wife is really sweet, like she's just a she's cute, like she's a little annoying, but she doesn't really do anything wrong, and she's nice to him. And so I love that she can just show the way that this man is And like many people in general are just like constantly chasing something that they think is better or that they think they can't have, and they're never happy with it. She's so good. It's crazy. And all while also making you laugh the entire time. Like it's not just making you angry with him. Like it's hilarious the entire time.
Yeah, he's the his character is probably always going to be desiring something because that's what he wants, is the desire. And once he
Yeah.
gets the thing, he doesn't want it anymore. And apparently there was an alternate ending that was shot that had been planned where and it was even noted in a synopsis that 20th Century Fox handed out at early screenings where Lenny and Kelly, which is Sybil Shepherd's character, go on a honeymoon and he makes some discoveries about her that he can't stand. And you
That's
real
awesome.
he's and you're like, okay, well that kind of I think if they had done that, that kind of gives him a little bit of an out that it's like, oh, he's just dumb and he doesn't realize that every woman he's going to be with is going to have some annoying qualities. And it's like, well, no, that's not what it's about. It's yes, the original woman that he's married in Jeannie Berlin, and Jeannie Berlin goes all in. The
Oh
stuff with
yeah,
like
she's
the egg
amazing.
salad sandwich and the like the, you know, the sunburn. Like she is kind of a nightmare, but that's not what it's about. It's not about that, oh, she's a nightmare, and that gives him an excuse to look around her. That's why he's looking around. This guy is a deeply unhappy person. And the final shot reveals that in a way
Yeah.
that I really think Elaine May is giving the audience a lot of credit because it doesn't. She doesn't underline it. Like it's just very simple. And when it ended, I was like, oh my God, that's the end of the movie. Wow.
Yeah,
And
and yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Like, I think that if they were to have kept that ending or if they hadn't cut it out, I don't know if they filmed it, but I think that the end already kind of tells you all of that without you having to see it. And I don't know. I don't know if we're like trying not to spoil the end or something, but I don't know if you haven't
I
seen
for
it,
anyone
like
who hasn't seen it, I
go
don't
and
want to
watch it and
ruin
then come
it,
back.
but it is just it, there's just something about I no movie nowadays would end like this,
Yeah.
would end this
I mean, it's
subtly,
like
never.
maybe this is too much of a spoiler, but like I mean it's almost exactly the same as the end of The Graduate. Not to
Yes,
bring
it
up Mike
is. Right.
Nichols.
Yeah, to bring it back to Mike Nichols, but you're right.
Yeah.
Yes, and yeah.
But I would almost say that like this is like you were saying, the end of this one is like slightly more subtle and less, I don't know, the end of The Graduate is almost like melancholy and it's like or it's like an oh shit moment. And this one, I feel like this one almost elicits a laugh more than it elicits any sort of sympathy. Because it, and a laugh in an absurd way, just like because everybody watching, I think I could say, knows that's how he would end up feeling this way. And you can see it the entire time, like the whole, at least to me, like the whole time that he's pursuing Kelly. You just know that he doesn't actually like her. You know, he just likes the idea of chasing her. And I think that's kind of what that different context is, what the makes the end so good. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like I said, and you know, something else about this, and I've said this before in other contexts, like, look, I love seeing movies on the big screen if I can. If there was an Alamo Draft House around here I could have gone to, I would have gone to see The Heartbreak Kid. That would have been so much better. And I love seeing, you know, I own Blu-rays and I love having the best quality image and sound and all of that stuff. That said, I have had some suboptimal experiences seeing some movies for the first time. And to me, if a movie is good enough, it will push through all of that. And
Yeah.
so I watched The Heartbreak Kid on YouTube. There are no commercials in it. Luckily, whoever uploaded it didn't try and monetize it by sticking ads in the middle of it. Thank God for that. But I mean, the picture quality wasn't great. I'm watching it on my television, you know, not the greatest. And yet I was completely wrapped up in this movie. Totally. And so to me, yes, Bristol Myers Squibb, whoever the frig owns this thing, license this to Kino Lorber or Criterion or
I have a
Shout
feeling it's going to be
Factory,
on.
somebody, and get
Yeah,
this out
it's
on
got to be
Blu-ray.
on Criterion at some point. Like they've got to be working on a restoration or something.
I hope so. I mean, it is staggering that this film is that hard to find. So look, when it eventually hopefully does come to Blu-ray, I will buy it because I'd love to have the nicest version available. But that said, I still thought this movie was so good that watching it even on YouTube, I still came away going, that was so good. I can't believe that this movie isn't more famous, you know? And unfortunately now, probably if you mention it, most people will only know the Ben Stiller version. Again, I haven't seen that movie. Maybe it's good. I don't know. I have my
I didn't even
doubts.
know that it had that remake, thank God. So I think also a part of another thing that I wanted to mention about just what makes both the writing and the structure so good. And I've noticed this with all of the films. It's interesting because I don't know if you agree with this, but I feel like all of her films are so different. Like, if you had told me a different person directed all of them, I would believe you
Oh,
because
yeah, totally.
they're also different. They vary so wildly. But I think that in all of her films, like the editing is really interesting. I don't know if she works with the same editor all the time, but like in this film, the way that it either like compressed or stretched out time, I thought was really interesting. Like, over ha from him getting ready to go on his date to like meeting her, and then they're getting married, and then they're going on this road trip, and then after he leaves her, that cut to the like Greyhound bus is an amazing way to just like skip over everything. And at, like the fact that after Lila never makes it past Florida, basically, like kind of like once she's out, she's out. And we don't see her reaction to any of it besides like at the dinner scene. But yeah, I think that also like creates some really great comedy. That she does it as well in Ishtar in some interesting ways that maybe aren't as successful. But yeah, I think that the editing is really cool. And him waiting for Kelly to get out of her classes, and he's like freezing in the car, and it's showing the passage of time by like how cold he is great.
I love her giant Norse boyfriends that they're like her entourage because she's this incredibly gorgeous, Nordic goddess, and so she's got men just dripping off her. But I love that she casts like all these guys are like 6'5". Guys are, and here's little nebbishy Charles Grodin trying to like start shit with them and pretending to be a cop and stuff like.
God, that was such a funny subversion. Like, that made me laugh so hard. Like that moment when he said like, I what was it? He was saying he's a police officer. He was saying that he was with like the Vice Squad or
Yeah, he's looking
something.
for drugs. Yeah, you smoke dope. You
Yeah,
smoke
and
dope.
like
You
that
smoke
made me
dope.
laugh so hard because it was such a subversion of like what? Like, you think he's gonna try to fight them or
Yep.
something?
I'm glad you mentioned the scene where they break. Again, I'm trying to get into too many details, even though this movie is 50 years old, for God's sakes. But the scene where they break up, right, is first of all, Elaine May doesn't really move the camera. It's I wasn't paying most attention about how many cuts are in it, but there's not a lot of cuts. But it's this scene where he has got to explain to his wife that he wants to break up with her, even though they have been together. They've been married like a week, right? And you're like, okay, this is impossible, right? For this to be real. No human could do this, could be this cruel. And it starts out as he's trying to be as vague as possible and hoping that she picks up on his on what he's laying down. And the scene starts absurdist because he just is dancing and dancing and dancing, and she's not getting it because how could she get it? Why would she think that that's where he's headed? Then she does get it, and she starts wailing, like cartoonishly wailing. So then the scene morphs into a broad comedy where she is just screaming, in this restaurant. But then she sort of collapses onto his shoulder and starts to weep. And then the scene becomes a full-on dramatic scene, and you're crushed. You're crushed because you're like, what this guy has just done. And he's done it in public to keep her from getting too out of hand. And you're like, this guy is the worst. And so this scene transforms. And I have to think that that's her from her her years as part of Nichols and May and as a playwright of just learning the stuff of being able to transform the scene. Where it goes from this kind of comedy to another kind of comedy to an absolute gut punch. You're just, even though Lila has been a cartoon to this point, you're so sympathetic to her because you're like, this guy has just hollowed her out by doing this to her.
That's such a good point. Like how she there's not many cuts in that scene. I besides the cuts to the other people in the restaurant who are
The waiter with
frustrated
the pie,
with
the
her.
waiter with the
Yeah. And I mean I also get the sense that I mean, I don't know how true this is, but like I get the sense that they did just shoot that in one shot and you know, like in post is when they were doing those inserts of the people in the restaurant. And yeah, I that it's so I feel like to me as the film went on, Lila became like more and more tragic and sad because it does reveal kind of slowly that she is like she's just a sweet person. Like she didn't do anything wrong. Like you said, she's just kind of has annoying traits. But
Who
she's so
doesn't?
forgiving of him. She like everything that he does, she's just like okay, like she gets mad at him to a reasonable extent. Like she's not a doormat, but then like she's trying, you know, it's a new marriage. Like she's trying to make it work, and he's just so terrible. And but she does the same. She being Elaine May does the same thing of no cutting and just like holding on the same shot in the scene where he's trying to convince Kelly's father to.
Oh.
I
Oh.
mean, I guess in both those scenes, but like the one when they're still in Florida, when he's just talking to her and he ends up like calling him an idiot or whatever, and they're just like at the table and like him and her father are in the foreground and Kelly and her mom are in the background. She does the same thing, and it's like absolute in both cases. It's just like brutal to watch because it's
Oh,
so
man.
awkward.
Eddie Albert has such a death stare in
Oh,
this movie,
he's
because
crazy.
he
So
just
good.
knows this guy is no good. And all he's trying to do is just keep this guy away from his daughter. And with everything that he does, he makes it worse. He's trying to do the right thing. He's trying to get this guy out. And he just, Grodin is just absolutely indefatigable. And man, I mean, again, Eddie Albert was in a lot of great movies. He's in Roman Holiday. I didn't even know that he was ever nominated. He was nominated for an Oscar for that movie too. But man, he is tremendous in a small role in this movie. And by the fact that this film seemed to have a relatively smooth production, it makes me sad to think, God, what she could have done, what kind of filmography she might have had if she. I don't know, like, why did that one go right when it seemed like all the other ones went way out of control? Now you could argue, in the end, who cares? The films are what matter, right? And if the films are good, and you've already talked about how much you love Mikey and Nikki. If the film is good, what difference does it make? But you also know that, yeah, but the fact that Mikey and Nikki, she shot 1.4 million feet of film for it, which was
Oh my
three
God.
times what they shot for Gone with the Wind. Like,
Oh my God.
that's what kept her from getting to do more films. And it's like, man,
Yeah.
why? How did Heartbreak Kid go so right when the rest of them spun out of control? Why was it? Why couldn't they replicate that experience? It's so frustrating.
Yeah, I it, it's yeah, it is it's funny 'cause like even though I do think that also but like I don't want to start talking about Mikey and Nikki yet, but like I do think that's also a masterpiece. Yeah, it's interesting. It just seems and you know, based on her like eclectic filmography, it does seem like she kind of just did what she felt like doing. And like if for Mikey and Nikki and also the fact that she was like friends with the people in Mikey and Nikki, that probably didn't help that they were like, oh, we should do this and like this will be funny or like this will be good and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it gets away from you. I don't blame her. You know, let her do whatever she wants. Give that woman millions and millions of dollars. I don't care. I don't know if it's like if you would have much to say about this, but like if you would have many thoughts on this. But I think it's interesting and that this is like semi-present in all of her films to Actually, in all of them that I can think of, except for A New Leaf, where like, so the Lila, his first wife, is like, it makes a point that either they're both Jewish or she's Jewish because like it's like a Jewish wedding. And she kind of is like a little bit of like a Jewish woman stereotype where she's like a little bit like she's a little eccentric and she's like very talkative, but you know, she's like sweet and stuff. But she it's like a little bit like stereotypy. And then Lenny is confronted with this like super waspy, blonde, like beautiful college girl
Oh God,
that
she's backlit. I mean, it's like she,
yeah,
yeah,
like
she's
that
unbelievably gorgeous in this film.
yeah, that has this like rich family, like super rich family, and they live in Colorado. It's like the most like waspy family you could possibly imagine. And the differences in their weddings as well, like his wedding to Lila, it was really small and it seemed like it was just family and stuff. And but you know, it was like still beautiful, but it was smaller. And then with Lila, it's like he has to get her father's approval, and it's like this whole like it's this whole thing of like it's like a whole pomp and circumstance almost of the things he has to do in order to marry her. I mean, you know, it doesn't help that she's like literally a college student who like still lives with her parents. But yeah, it's funny like seeing that difference. I feel like Jewishness or like a char like characters being Jewish like plays kind of a heavy role in all three of the films, like the fourth one being besides A New Leaf, which it doesn't really come up, but like it comes up in Mikey and Nikki and Ishtar and this one, and like not in a super heavy way, but like she definitely seems to make a point of it, and it's I think it's interesting, and like I think that you could definitely talk more about how like he gives up this like Jewish woman for like the most waspy person you could possibly imagine for yourself.
Yeah, there was a lot. There was, I mean, that as someone who's not Jewish, that's like a reading that I had to pick up on when I was later on, and I was reading analysis of the film. They're talking about how his character is completely cutting off his identity to live this life of this, white total WASP privilege, and the way he is just negating his whole past, because obviously the wedding that he has at the beginning is like a very Jewish wedding. It's all of his Jewish relatives, and it's, has all those sort of like cliched trappings. And yet he's going to go live. I think it's Minnesota or Colorado, or I forget one of
I
the
think it's
states.
Colorado,
And
yeah.
it's just he's going to, and he's, and at the reception, when he finally does get married to Kelly, like he's so out of place. And he's put himself there, and he will never fit in because of who, because he just never, he's inserted himself into this process. No one wants him there, and he'll always be kind of alone no matter. And it's just, again, it's just devastating.
So
I just, oh,
good.
by the way, you mentioned, I was looking, he's the, her editor on this film on Heartbreak Kid was John Carter, and that guy also edited Mikey and Nikki. So she
There
did
you
work
go.
on two. He did not do New Leaf or Ishtar, but nevertheless she did work with the same guy on both those films. But man, it's just I think the Heartbreak Kid is just so good.
Yeah.
So okay, Mikey and Nikki, why do you love Mikey and Nikki so much?
Whoa, man, there's so all the reasons why don't I love Mikey and Nikki. It's so good. I think that, well, obviously, like Peter Falk, John Cassavetes, need I say more, first of all. And I think that I also just love like New Holly that like New Hollywood cinema spirit of like this kind of film of like there's only a couple locations, you can tell it's super low budget. It does have that as you mentioned earlier, like it does have that John Cassavetes feel. Like it feels like it should be done by John Cassavetes. And I think that I mean the chemistry between them works so well. Like obviously they're like best friends in real life, and that really comes across in the film. Like the characters have amazing chemistry. Like, there's so much history with them that you can see that's beyond just the script. And I think that there's, I mean, I don't want to ramble, but like, of stuff that we'll talk about as well. But like, the way that she reveals information is perfect. Like, it's so good, both about the plot of the film and about the character relationships, like how they know each other and how long they've known each other, and actually the fact that like Mikey knows about, like, he's there to, you know, get him killed and all that kind of stuff. I think the way that she reveals information is incredible, and it like breaks my heart. It's so sad, like, which I love. I love being heartbroken by a film.
I will say, at the risk of spoiling it, one character dies with a pile of comic books in his hand, and as a longtime comic fan, that's how a lot of us want to go. Is that the kind of thing we get to see? He's got a copy of Jughead in his hand as he dies. It does say something that Elaine May, who I get, I don't know how much she knew John Cassavetes or Peter Falk socially or professionally, but it says something that she could shoot a film that seems so relaxed. Even though she wrote it, she apparently allowed for massive improvisation, which is why they ended up shooting so much film, so much feet of film for this movie. But it's I think that's really interesting that she could shoot the film with these two guys who, as you mentioned, clearly were best buddies. Falk was in like almost every Cassavetes film from a certain period, in a row. And yet she could sort of insert herself into that relationship and be able to show it on screen convincingly. You could see that if it was a Cassavetes film and he's directing it, and sometimes he was in his film, sometimes he wasn't. But it's like, oh, okay, they all know each other, and it's kind of this rolling party that he's going from film to film to film. But here's Elaine May kind of showing up out of nowhere and sort of making a Cassavetes film, which is, again, remarkable. And like you said, you watch that film and you compare it to Heartbreak Kid and A New Leaf, and you're like, the same person did these three movies?
Yeah, it's crazy.
So.
Yeah, she's so flexible, like, and but you can see her sort of her, how should I call it, like, her sense of humor, I guess, in this film, I think, with just like the way that they speak to each other. And I think those moments of realization are really important in all of her films. Like, there's always moments where a character looks at another one and like realizes something about their relationship that they can never unsee. And there are a couple moments like that in Mikey and Nikki, in both like funny ways and heartbreaking ways and like infuriating ways. And oh my God, it's so good. I'm gonna like cry talking about this movie. It's so amazing. Yeah, I mean, like, the one that I think of is when, oh my goodness, when they're sitting on the bus and he's like yelling at that woman who's telling him, Nikki is yelling at that woman who's telling him to stop smoking, and he's just like looking at him and like not paying attention at all, but he says like, he's saying like, "You have big hands, like you could have been a piano player." And I think that's just one of those moments of like, that's not a comedic moment, but it's like a thing where he's realizing that he knows him so intimately, but at the same time, like, he's realizing that there's so many things that he never noticed in the first place, or like never knew, like the fact that his sister showed him how to play the piano a little bit and stuff. Yeah, and that happens in like the Heartbreak Kid, of him realizing that he hates his wife. It happens in A New Leaf, of him like realizing that he wants to save her instead of let her drown, all that kind of stuff. So I think it's great.
The scene is funny. I had not seen Mikey and Nikki until we were preparing for this, and I really did enjoy it. It definitely is the kind of movie I think that requires a certain mood to be in. Like I tried to watch it on like a Saturday morning, and I just it was not clicking with me. And then I watched it again, like I think the next night, but at like 7 o'clock at night. And then I got into it. So there was something about the bright morning of the 9:30 a.m. sun. It was just like, I don't want to, this is, I'm
Yeah,
not in the
it's
mood for
definitely like
these.
a dingy, you have to
Yeah.
like be in the same headspace as them of like not
Yes,
having slept in a
totally.
while.
Because it's just like a hangout movie, these two guys. But when I was watching it, right, and they go to Nikki's girlfriend's house, and for a minute, or her apartment, and for a minute or two, you don't see her face clearly. You just see her from the back, and she's kind of got like a platinum blonde hair. And I was like, "Is that Jenna Rollins?" Because of course, I'm
I thought
thinking
the
Jenna
same
Rollins, right?
thing. I thought the same thing.
Right, because you're like, well, of course it's Jenna Rollins because it's a John Cassavetes movie and they're married. Why wouldn't it be Jenna Rollins? And then she finally turns her head and you see that, oh, it's not Jenna Rollins, it's another actress. Okay. And then I remember just thinking, huh, I wonder why they just wouldn't even get Jenna Rollins to do this, right?
She's too strong for that role. Like,
That's
she's too,
exactly it. After you see what how Nikki and then later Mikey treats her. You go, oh, this woman's a doormat, and nobody's buying that Jenna Rollins is going to be a doormat. So that's why they didn't
Never,
get Jenna
never
Rollins.
in her life would she be in a role
She was like,
like
she would not put up with that shit from
that.
either one of those guys. So that's exactly it, Melissa. I was sitting there going, that's so funny. And then, oh, I see. No. That's like, she would deck them both and throw them down the stairs. I'm like, okay, I got it. I got it.
God, I love her.
Oh my God. Yeah.
I think, it's interesting. That is also another scene where she like really loves to hold. Like, it's interesting she does cut a lot in this film. Like, I think probably based on the like improvisational nature of how they filmed it. Like, there's a lot of cutting going on, but in that particular scene when Nikki, I always get their names, I get their names mixed up. When Nikki's on the couch with her and Mikey is like in the kitchen, first of all, the way that that's lit is
Oh,
absolutely
it's
incredible.
so awkward, it seemed.
I mean, like with the light in the kitchen on and it like completely dark in the rest of the frame, it's just so good. But that is held on for so long and it's to a similar effect than how she did it in The Heartbreak Kid, where it's like, it's making it awkward, but it also becomes like it goes from heartbreaking to awkward, or like maybe the other way around, more like awkward to heartbreaking, which is sad. Because it's like at first you're like, oh my God, like
They're
she, you
getting
know,
it on
she
while he's
feels,
just sitting in the kitchen.
yeah,
What's
like she
happening?
feels weird. She's like not in front of him. Like, I don't, like, that's weird. And then you're watching Mikey just kind of like waiting and I don't know. Like I thought it was really interesting. And now it's time to talk about the like homosocial, I should say, implications of this film. Because like I think that scene, the way that Peter Falk plays it is really like it's kind of hard to read what his emotion is. And like I personally, I don't know about you, maybe you got it more than I did, but like I kind of forgot from like the first time I watched it, because I watched it for the first time so long ago. But I kind of forgot that afterward Mikey gets mad at him. Like he thinks that Nikki is like sticking it to him, basically. But like in the scene before they fight about that, I felt it kind of hard to read Mikey's emotion. Like it was almost like he was like he didn't want to leave the room because he didn't want to leave Nikki alone with her. Like he was sort of like jealous of her in a way.
Interesting. That's
Yeah, and I think
interesting.
that shot like really like I mean the fact that you're like so focused on him in the kitchen while like you know what's going on in the foreground. Yeah. And there's like a certain look that he gives once it goes on a close up of him and while he's sitting down in the kitchen where like it's like such a pained look. And to me, I was like having a hard time reading what that was supposed to be giving you, but then and then they talk about it afterward. But I think that's a good thing that it's like a little hard inscrutable, I guess.
Yeah, it's a really interesting movie. And unfortunately, it met the same fate kind of as A New Leaf, in that she shot so much footage, she went way over budget that Paramount took it away from her. And because she missed the delivery date, she lost the ability to have final cut. And it really got acrimonious to the point where she was literally hiding reels of film at a husband's friend's garage in Connecticut. I mean, that's
Oh,
how
wow.
sort of petty this became. And, you know, it's kind of funny. The film as it runs is 106 minutes. It's, I mean, it's they, I can't imagine if she shot 4 hours of footage or whatever, she thought that 106 minute version is probably thinking it's butchered. But I don't know. I mean, the film that as it exists, it's like, this is, I thought this was pretty good. I hate that. I mean, it is edited by her editor. Again, that guy, John Carter. And so she apparently said she couldn't stand to watch another one of her films get butchered. But I don't, you know, I don't know. I mean, I thought it ended up pretty well considering.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's perfect the way that it is. I'm sorry, Miss May, but but I think it's wonderful. Yeah, I think it's interesting to imagine like just how much they probably shot because it is so clearly like very improvised.
Yeah.
But I also, like you were kind of saying earlier, I don't think that that ultimately like matters that much. Like it's unfortunate that it was so butchered, but honestly, I have also seen director's cuts of films that are worse than like the theatrical version. So, I don't know. Who knows like what it would have ended up being like. You know, maybe she wouldn't have made it super long, like she just would have done a different cut.
Maybe. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of what you and I have talked about this when you guessed it on Pod Dylan, where it's like Bob has a version of a song in his head, and if he doesn't achieve it, he regards it as a failure. Well, we can't judge it like that. We can only judge the final product. And we're like, wow, the final product is amazing. How can you not like this? And so it's like the same idea. I'm sure Elaine May, if she shoots 4 hours of, you know, if she assembles a rough cut of the movie and it's 4 hours long and Paramount cuts it down to 106, she looks at it like it's been butchered. But we don't have that reference. We don't have the film in her head. We only have what's in front of us. And you're like, well, this is really good. I don't know. But like, what's, why don't you, why are you unsatisfied? Why are you dissatisfied with it? Well, because she's seeing the ultimate version in her head. We're like,
Of
well, all
course.
right, but that's okay. You know, you got to get past that. But anyway, it's the film was a big, not a success. And so she doesn't direct again for 10 years. And now, part of the reason Ishtar comes about, ironically enough, is related to those problems we were talking about, is that Warren Beatty, now she had helped out Warren Beatty because she had become a screenwriter. And she had worked on Heaven Can Wait, which was Warren Beatty's movie. It was a giant hit. She had worked off the books kind of on Reds, his other big project, which I think is a terrific movie. And he really liked her and he felt he owed her. And he looked at the trouble she had had and said, you need a strong producer to kind of be at your back, to have your back. And that for you there, that way you can make the movie you want to make. And I'm going to be your producer. That's how we're going to do this. Now, of course, he's Warren Beatty. And so him being in the movie helps get it made. But that it came from a great noble purpose, which was to, you know, from Warren Beatty looking at her filmography and saying, you should be working more. You shouldn't be having these troubles. I'll be the guy who's defending you to the studio. You just make your movie. Unfortunately, that's not what happened. I mean, we don't need to, we've already been talking for an hour. We don't need to go on and on about Ishtar. I saw the movie when it came out. It at the time, it was one of those movies where it came pre-sold as, oh, this is a stinker. There were articles about the budget. And critics were just dying to get their knives out for this film. And so it was like before anyone even had a chance to really enjoy it on their own terms, it came preloaded as like, oh boy, this thing is a debacle. Now, I'd love to say, oh, you know what, with the hindsight of 40, 30 years, it's a hidden masterpiece. I didn't find that to be the case when I
Yeah,
watched
I
it.
have to agree with
Yeah,
that.
I watched it and I went, oh, this just isn't funny. And I think I'm curious what you think about this, Melissa, because you don't probably have a real great preconception about Warren Beatty. I mean, you know who he is, certainly, but like you didn't grow up with him being the cultural force that he was when I was younger. I Look, it's awesome seeing Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman in a movie together because they're two giant stars and it's fun seeing them together. My problem with it is, more than anything else, I do not buy Warren Beatty as a hapless loser.
It's funny because, like, obviously he's playing against type, but like you
And
said,
all
I didn't.
credit to him for trying something. I mean, it's not like, oh, only Warren Beatty should only play Lotharios because that's all he does. No, he's done when he can do McCabe and Mrs. Miller or not 3 Days of the Condor. That's Robert
The
Redford.
Parallax View.
Parallax, you thank you. Yes, he can play different, but to me, I'm like, I'm just not buying this, that he's this much. Hoffman somehow is able to do it. Hoffman,
Well,
when
yeah,
he.
because Hoffman is kind of like, I mean, he's similar to Pacino in the sense that like he's playing a loser fairly often. And I think, yeah, Warren Beatty, I mean, I didn't have the like I don't have the baggage, like the cultural baggage of Warren Beatty. I mean, I've seen McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Parallax View, and Bonnie and Clyde, and I know that those are his like classics. But I also it's like I just didn't like he's not in the cultural conversation quite as much and so anymore. So like I didn't have that notion going in, but I was still like shocked to see him acting the way that he does. And like you said, good for him, you know, like there's nothing wrong with doing a role against type. But yeah, I didn't buy it. I felt like I don't know if he just like wasn't that good at I think he just wasn't that good at playing that. 'Cause like I've seen, you know, like well, maybe I shouldn't use this example. I was gonna, maybe a good example of that is like Jon Hamm trying to do comedies, which he so desperately wants to. And he's kind of funny, you know, like he's not funny. But it's like very much playing against type. Yeah, I thought like you know, Dustin Hoffman, he's so funny. I think that he's great. Like I love Dustin Hoffman in like everything that I've seen him in. But I think that I hate to say it, but like I think the script just isn't funny. And like the editing is it go I don't know if this is like Elaine May's influence or like I see I'm looking right now and there are three editors on this film, which is evident, I think, because each bit goes on so long. Rob, I had to watch his movie. I hate like I really hate to say this. I never ever do this, but I had to watch his movie in like three sittings because I started watching it. I was like cat sitting for my friend, and I started watching her house, and then I was like, and then I realized that I had to like I don't know do so like I had to do something for that or. And then I was like, I can't like watch this anymore. And I had to just like three separate times, I had to like try to finish it. And it's not that long of a movie. And it's, I think it
It's
is.
one minute longer than Mikey and Nikki, but it feels five times longer.
Oh my God. I felt like I was watching that movie for days on end. And like, it's just so repetitive. I don't want to like just rag on it too much because obviously it got that when it came out. And like everybody's heard it all before, but like I don't know. It just it takes so long for the inciting incident to happen. And like I didn't really care about the two characters all that much enough to like care about their backstory. And it took so long for them to even get to Ishtar. Oh my God.
Then they get
Like
separated. Then they're separated for a long period of time. Like, again,
yeah.
for anyone who hasn't seen it, I can the plot. I'm doing just two lines, just so anyone knows what we're talking about. Is about two hopeless singer-songwriters that are desperate for work. They take a gig in Morocco. While they're there, they meet a mysterious woman and get involved in a CIA-backed plot to overthrow the emir. So we mentioned it's Dustin Hoffman and Warren Beatty. Isabella Johnny plays the woman, the mysterious woman named Shira. Charles Grodin, once again, Charles Grodin plays the CIA agent. Jack Weston plays their manager who gets them this gig. And it also features Carol Kane as Dustin Hoffman's erstwhile girlfriend and Tess Harper. I actually thought the only person that was funny in this movie was Charles Grodin.
Yeah, he was great. He was funny.
I read that they said the original idea was they wanted to update the old Bing Crosby, Bob Hope road movies, and I love those movies. I don't necessarily think that's even a bad idea, although you could argue they just did that a year earlier with Dan Aykroyd and Chevy Chase and Spies Like Us. And that movie's very silly because it's a straight up comedy, not that Ishtar is not. But the problem with doing a road movie like this is the road movies, the old road movie. Have you ever seen any of those, the
I
Crosby
haven't.
Hope
I,
movies?
I know of them, and I knew that this film was like trying to do that, but yeah, I have
I
kind of a blind spot in terms of like 40s, 50s comedies.
yeah, I enjoy them, but you have to view them in the perspective of when they were made. And so it's like these two guys are going to different cultures. Nobody playing the other cultures are the race of the people they're playing, you
Of
know.
course.
You've got Anthony Quinn playing like a Saudi Arabian prince kind of thing, a knife wielding. And it's like, look, okay, you can laugh at them then because that's how those movies were made. But having these guys kind of wander around the Middle East and make like, oh, the camel is blind, and oh, don't these people talk funny? And you're just like that, no, we're past this now. And so, you know, updating the road film on paper is not a bad idea, but not where we have a bunch of kind of rich American actors coming and sort of making fun of people in Morocco. It just feels like, no, this is just off. This whole tone is just really off.
And like I definitely, I mean like I watched so many movies from the 60s and 70s, and there's like things that I can tell. And like, I mean, I don't know if you're a Columbo fan. Like I am. I love Columbo.
I've seen some Columbo. I've not seen a whole ton of it.
Oh
I
my God.
enjoy it when I watch it, but for some reason I just don't go back to it a whole lot.
I love it so much. But and you know, there are certain parts in that and like other 60s, 70s films where like, and also like the monkeys, if you watch the monkeys, if you're a monkeys kid growing up.
I grew up, I haven't seen it in a long time, but I grew up watching it.
Yeah, there are a lot of parts where it's like you can tell that you're supposed to be laughing at this because it's like, oh, it's like guys with like face coverings, like isn't that so funny? And like people with accents, like isn't that hilarious? And like you can tell that you're kind of supposed to be laughing at it, but usually those films are like Columbo or the monkeys and stuff, like have something else to offer on top of that that makes it funny otherwise. And I feel like a lot of this film was lacking that. And like I didn't even feel like they were making fun of it all that much, other than, well, like, yes, I guess they were, but like oftentimes the joke was obviously on like Dustin Hoffman and Warren
Right,
Beatty.
they're the clueless idiots.
Yeah, but it still made it like I can imagine. I don't know. I mean, like 1987 is kind of late to be like doing jokes like that. But like, I imagine that like maybe a 1987 audience would find it funnier, but obviously they didn't.
No, right. I mean, to be fair to this movie, the press just was salivating to rip it apart. And that's not fair. That's not fair to the movie because then you're just kind of like, I can't wait for this thing to be a piece of shit so I can write my review. And that's not what you're supposed to do. Now, yeah, it cost $40 million, which back then was absolutely gargantuan budget. But in the end, that really shouldn't matter. You really should just get that out of your mind and just say, am I laughing? Am I engaged in this? And if I am, what difference does it make? Because who I'm a movie. It's like, you know, you find out Disney spent $200 million and we're like, well, if they're going to lose their shirt on this, but what do I care? It's coming out of my pocket, but it's, you know, the one other thing I find, and this is just my personal taste, is like, I find it dodgy when very successful people, and you know, it's always going to be actors because it was in the context of a movie or a TV show. I find it very uncomfortable when very successful people are playing people that are failures of the industry that they're in, because it's always like, it always feels like punching down a little bit, you know? Now, and that line can be really, I kind of feel that way about like the Christopher Guest movies. Like sometimes I feel like he's very sympathetic to these people and then it's funny. And then other times I feel like he's just being really nasty and I don't laugh. And I feel like this movie has that, like, oh, aren't these two hapless? Like, all right, but they want to be like you guys were struggling at one point too. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. It just feels a little weird to have Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman kind of eviscerating two hapless singer-songwriters. But at the same time, yes, they are awful and they're deluded. You know, I mean, when they do the concert for the army, at least everyone in the army is like, God, these guys are terrible. Like, at least it's like, you know, like no one else is full. Like, these guys are just absolutely horrendous.
Yeah, I think that like it I think the film wanted you to find those parts funnier, like them being just really bad at their act or whatever. I like 'cause they went on so long. And I think that it wanted you to think that was just like the funniest thing in the world. And it just was it was just annoying. Like, it's not like what they were singing was funny. They were just doing, it was just bad and annoying. And so it like, I don't know. It just like goes on for so long and I don't care.
I think it's instructive that her former partner, Mike Nichols, his last film is Charlie Wilson's War, which actually we talked about on the show last year. I had director Joan Darling talking to me about Mike Nichols. She was friends with Mike Nichols, but that film is only moderately successful. And to me, the stuff that's least successful about that film are all the scenes set in the Middle East. So it's like, okay, Nichols and May, just stay away from the Middle East. Like, just stay away. Just keep away from it. Now, of course, Elaine May is the first subject of a fade out who is still with us. Every other person that we've covered is no longer around. So therefore, absolutely, the career is over. But in 2019, it was announced that Elaine May is set to direct another movie. Little is known about the project other than its title, Crackpot, and that it is set to star Dakota Johnson, who is,
That's
you know,
crazy.
Dakota, you know, John, big star. Johnson said that the film is still in development and she serves as the film's producer and star, with May still set to direct. Now, I have not heard anything else about it since then. I think Dakota Johnson mentioned it in one or two places. When she was on the kind of the infamous Madame Web press tour. But as far as I know, it's still in development. I don't know. I mean, how confident are you that this is gonna happen?
I don't know. I mean, I'll just say I'll believe it when I see it. But I mean, I really hope that it happens. I think that, like, I hate to say it, like, I don't know if it'll be good, but like, I don't, I'm excited to see it. Yeah, I don't know. Like, if they announced that in 2019, it's been, I
That's
mean, I know
5 years
like
ago, yeah.
happened, but it's been 5 years. Like, come on, people. But I guess COVID probably like
Well, that's
backed
true. Yeah,
it up a
that
little bit.
slowed it down. I mean, I would think that you could, if it's like a romantic comedy, as long as it's nothing too ambitious, like you really could keep the budget, like, you know, okay, say, okay, the budget is like $40 million. That's what we're doing. You know, like keep the budget on this. And make sure it doesn't get super out of. It would be amazing for her to come back after 30 years. So part of the reason originally when we heard about this, everybody, to pull the curtain back a little, we thought about not doing Elaine May as a subject at all because we're like, well, she's still maybe Ishtar isn't the last film. But so what we're doing here is we're kind of like using like you know, sort of a spiritual terms. We're trying to manifest this. We're trying to dare
Yeah,
Elaine
exactly.
May. Don't make Ishtar your last film. Don't let this episode be actually about your last movie, Miss May. Please get this movie done. Go direct another film. That would be awesome. Let's get Crackpot, if that's still the title. Let's absolutely get it made. And so related to that, Melissa, I mean, we have other things we can talk about, but related to that, I want to ask you the exit question for this show, which is again specific to my guest and the subject. And so what I asked you is, let's say Crackpot is going to get made, and let's assume Dakota Johnson is going to be the star. Like, that hasn't changed. But if who would else would you love to see? What would be your dream cast of an Elaine May movie in 2025?
Okay, I thought about this a little bit. I have no idea what the plot of this movie is. But the first person I thought of was was Michael Shannon, that king. Famously in Well, so many things. What's oh my God, the Guillermo del Toro picture.
Oh, the Shape of Water.
Yeah, The Shape of Water. He's in Knives Out. That film Shelter. He's been in so many things, but
Truly terrifying actor. It's just that
yeah, he
stare, yeah.
and but he's so funny. Like, he's an incredible dramatic actor. But in Knives Out, he's like the funniest man you've ever seen in your life. He's so funny. And I think that like insane look that he has would really lend itself to like the Elaine May treatment. Like, I think she could really do a lot with that face. And he has just like an incredible sense of timing. I think he's so funny. I also put Emma Stone. She did like, she still kind of does like comedic stuff. She did a lot more comedy like earlier in her career. She's so funny in Crazy Stupid Love and all of the comedies that she did earlier on. And I think she would be incredible. And now thinking about it as if like they're next to Dakota Johnson, I think that maybe she would, I hate to say it, but maybe she would like out-act her a little bit. But I think they would be funny together. I think those are like the two big ones. I also wrote down Michael Stuhlbarg, who I love.
I love
And
Michael Stuhlbarg.
yeah, he's so funny. He doesn't do that much comedy, but I think that he has the potential. And
Oh, but he
Julianne
can do
Moore.
cringe comedy so well, like A
Oh
Serious
yeah.
Man, the Coen Brothers movie.
Oh
So, oh
yeah.
man,
Like
he fits in like the Heartbreak Kid kind of mold perfectly. So that's a
oh
great
yeah,
pick.
he plays like the fool really well.
Yes, that's a great pick. That's a great pick.
And I also put down Julianne Moore because she's awesome and she's great.
Well, okay. All right, everybody. A couple of months ago, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Melissa. I'm going to mention something I didn't plan on mentioning. But a couple of months
Okay.
ago, Melissa was on one of my final Pod Dylans, and we did a question, me and her and two other guests, we did a questionnaire, and I gave them a bunch of questions to answer, and then we were going to answer live on air, right? And so one of the questions that I picked was, name a Bob Dylan song that you want to turn into a movie. And Melissa and the other two guests and I all had this same exact answer, which was Tweeter and the Monkey Man, a Traveling Wilburys song. And I was stunned that, all three of you had the same exact answer as me, right? That was amazing. Well, you've done it again.
Shut up.
I am not joking. I have Michael Shannon here on my list. I
That's
honestly did. When you said it, I'm like, this is getting weird. You're
crazy.
like incepting me or something. This is getting
That's
really strange.
crazy.
I actually did him. I was like, he is so terrifying and so good at comedy, but weird that I'm like, I would love to see Elaine May directing that energy. So that is when you said Michael, as I cannot believe
That
out
is
of
the
the
craziest thing ever, Rob.
thousands
What
of
the
names
hell?
we could have picked, you picked the same one. That is, you're just on the same wavelength, Melissa. This is eerie.
Great minds. Great
Man.
minds.
Now, my other picks, I went with something a little more like not so much related to, although Michael Stuhlbarg, I wish I had thought of that because that's a great pick. Oh my God, you imagine the Heartbreak Kid and like A Serious Man as a double feature. That would be insane.
Oh my
You want to
God.
kill yourself at the end.
Wow.
I went the other way and just went totally commercial. And I was like, let's get her the hottest cast imaginable. So like get her Glenn Powell and Sydney Sweeney and like,
Oh my God.
you know what I mean? Like
Timmy
I don't,
Chalamet.
yeah, exactly. Get Chalamet. I don't care if they fit with her. I just want it to be a hit. So Elaine May can have one last home run as her, because I mean, she's like in her 90s. Like very few 90-year-olds direct movies, let alone women in Hollywood. That's even more rare. So it's like odds are, I think if this film's taking 5 years to get made, this is going to be it for Elaine May. And I would just like, I want people to be like, oh, you know what? I just want to be in her movie. That's it. I don't care. And so just lard it up with the biggest names that people want to go see movies. So get Sydney Sweeney, even though her and Dakota Johnson did Madame Web and that didn't go well. But I don't care. Just get the hottest people and put them in the movie. And there you go. Who's Challengers? I'm blanking on her name. Zendaya. Get
Oh,
Zendaya in
Zendaya.
there. Like, just do that. I don't care. But oh my God, Michael Shannon, yes.
That is crazy. That is absolutely psychotic. That
So
is insane.
it would be great. So Again, we kind of brushed by Ishtar as the final film because I, again, neither one of us have a whole lot to say about it. It's an unfortunate thing, and Hoffman and Beatty moved on. In fact, Hoffman ended up being in a cameo role in Warren Beatty's next film as director, Dick Tracy, a film that I love. So it's like they didn't really suffer that much from it, but poor Elaine May, just that was it. You're never going to get to
Yeah, I
direct
mean,
again.
I to say something, no, I guess maybe we should say something nice about Ishtar to end it in order to not like end it on a sour note about her career. But I mean, I don't think it's so bad that it justified her never working as a
No, of
director again.
course not.
Like, it's just kind of an averagely like bad comedy. It's not like offensively horrible. I mean, it's pretty bad, but it's like it's not career ending bad when you've made something like Mikey and Nikki or like The Heartbreak Kid. How can you never let her work again? It's crazy.
Yeah, our male directors get to blow hundreds of millions of dollars. They get next chances, and it's like,
Yeah, and maybe
why,
that's like the unspoken thing is that like she is considered this like really successful performer, director, actress, writer, like comedian. I mean, she wrote after that, obviously, like The Birdcage is one of the best comedies ever.
Yeah, right. Yes.
But it's like the fact that she was never able, I don't know if she like it was by choice or she just kind of wasn't really allowed to in a certain way. But like the fact that she was never able to direct again, it really does like point to like an inability for the industry to have any sort of leeway with women, because like of course there have been like directors, like male directors that have had flops and then they don't really direct stuff again, but that is like oftentimes when that is like the only thing they do is they direct. But she's like a quadruple threat, like she does everything, and of course like she stayed successful in other ways, but like I don't know, I think if Mike Nichols, which had a really horrible film in the 70s, and I haven't seen all of his films, but like I'm sure he's had a stinker in there. Like if he had a bad film like that, like he wouldn't be immediately like put in director jail like she was. So
I mean, it is worth pointing out that the film, one of the films that really sank Mike Nichols for a long time was 1976's The Fortune, starring Warren Beatty. So,
oh
like
my.
another thing they have in common, where like Warren Beatty agrees to do these kind of wacky comedies, and then it's a disaster. And that movie co-stars Jack Nicholson.
Oh my God.
That's
And I
another
love,
one of
I
those
mean,
movies that you're like, how can that miss? And then you watch it and you go, yeah, this misses. This is just
if you
this
can
misses
squander
big.
Jack Nicholson, you have a talent for squandering.
Exactly, right? So you're like, well, maybe it's Warren Beatty. Maybe Warren Beatty shouldn't be in goofy comedies with
Yeah.
another huge star because it doesn't seem to work. So yeah, Nichols might should have said something to Elaine, like, oh, I don't know. Maybe you don't want to do this with Warren. I don't know.
Yeah.
And look, I mean, yes, you're right. You're totally right, Melissa. I never want to end these shows on a down note, even when we're talking about someone's final film that isn't very good. I always like, so what? Okay, it's worth talking about because that's the hook of the show. But I'm always like, but they have other work that's worth celebrating. And yes, they do. And in fact, you would argue that for someone who's only directed four films, her batting average was 750, which is pretty good. New Leaf, I'd say, is pretty good. Mikey Nikki, I think, is great. And I think The Heartbreak Kid is a masterpiece. So pretty good. Pretty good resume
Yeah.
on as a director, I would say.
I agree. Yeah, I think she's brilliant and I hope that she makes another one. And if it's bad, I don't care. Like she can, it can be bad. I think that directors should be working until the day they drop dead. I think God willing, all of us are able to do that. So
Yeah. Oh,
I
yeah.
hope
No, absolutely. Let's get crackpot made, everybody. What do we have to
that.
do? Do we have to GoFundMe it? What do we need to do? I don't
I'll
know.
do it. I'll throw $10 in
You'll throw
there.
it. Absolutely. So, by the way, we should mention that just a couple of days after, if you're listening to this episode the day it drops, I think in just a week, from now, there is going to be a biography of Elaine May out in bookstores. It's called Miss May Does Not Exist, The Life and Work of Elaine May. It's by Carrie Kurogin. I believe that's how you say her name. It's expected on June 4th. We both tried to kind of get our hands on the book before this episode because I'd love to read it, but it just didn't work out. So I really look forward to that. That'll be really interesting to kind of read all the backstories. I might jump right to the Heartbreak Kid chapter because I'm just fascinated of how, for someone who had such troubled productions, she could produce this one thing that seemed to go very smoothly and argue it to me is her best film and is an absolutely amazing film. And maybe with the added attention maybe Elaine May is getting, because again, she's around, she does interviews, she just did an interview with TCM not that long ago, that we can finally get Heartbreak Kid, as you mentioned, Melissa, someone's got to be working on it, right? Somebody's got to be working on it. But we can hope so. So check out the work of Elaine May, everybody. There's some really amazing stuff. So Melissa, thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it.
I will
say, and I don't mean to embarrass you, but as I've already mentioned a couple times, Pod Dylan, you were one of my regulars on Pod Dylan. I always enjoy. We tended to be talking about movies related to Bob. That tended to be your subject. And while I have zero regrets about ending the show, it ran for 8 years and it came time to wrap it up. One of the things that gave me a little bit of pause when I decided to end it was, I was like, wow, there's a bunch of people that I really enjoy talking to and I'm cutting that off. I'm taking that out of my life by ending the show. That's kind of a negative. And so when I can glom one of those people over to another one of my shows, it makes me very happy because it makes me think, oh, well, the conversations about geeky stuff that we love can continue. And so I really appreciate you doing this. I always enjoyed our Pod Dylans. And so I really enjoyed this. So thank you for coming on and doing this with me.
Thank you. I feel the exact same way. I always have fun. Pod Dylan was always so much fun. And I'm just glad that we are now free from the constraints of Dylan movies. And we can talk about anything we want.
Absolutely. You pitched some other names to me. And by the way, this is something I'm going to mention. A show that I sort of brainstormed live on air on one of our Pod Dylans when I was talking with Melissa on one of the episodes we did was, I want to do an episode of Fade Out, which breaks the format a little, where I'm not going to be talking about a person. We're going to talk about movies that had absolutely perfect final scenes. Perfect final scenes.
I've got my list.
Yes. And Melissa, you're going to be my guest on that because you mentioned it and you said you wanted to do it. And I think that'd be a lot of fun. So, and that's like the Heartbreak Kid is one of those things where I go, that movie has an absolutely stone cold perfect ending. It couldn't end any other way. And it guts you to do it. So, and I'm also going to open it up a little to the listeners. So what I want to do is if you're listening to this, you can find the email address to the show in the show notes. And you can also contact the show on Twitter at Fade Out Pod. We're also on Blue Sky at Fade Out. If there's a movie that to you has an absolutely perfect ending, submit it, submit the film and submit the final scene. Now, when we're talking about final scenes, how, you know, what counts as a final scene? Does it have to be just one scene? Can it be a couple of minutes? That's kind of your discretion, you know, it really depends on how, and we're not talking about Citizen Kane, you know, oh, it's the sled or, you know, that kind of thing where it's the most, or Planet of the Apes, you know, obviously those are masterpiece endings. But I'm talking about endings that really worked for you. Is there a movie that out there that you really love that you think, oh my God, did they stick the landing? That is, and I have a list of them and Melissa has a few. And so that's something that in a couple of months, maybe near the end of the year, maybe for the Christmas show, if we get enough submissions in, we'll come back and Melissa will come back. We'll do the show together and we'll talk about some of our favorite endings. And we can incorporate some suggestions from all you listeners out there about what you think are some great endings. Because I've always been fascinated at how a film really, if it goes out strong. And so the Heartbreak Kid made me think, man, that's a movie that goes out strong. So that's going to be something that Melissa and I will do. So again, Melissa, I'm looking forward to doing that show. Whenever we do it, I'm looking forward to having you on again.
Me too.
So again, thank you all for listening. You can find all the back episodes on our website, fineandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to Fade Out on any podcatcher of your choice. I already mentioned that we're on Twitter and Blue Sky. And if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW podcasts. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Monique D and Donna McWaters for their support of Fade Out. So thanks for listening. We'll be back with another episode next month, but we've reached the end of this particular script. So for now, it's time to fade out.
After Ishtar, you kind of stopped directing movies. Why?
You know, that's always a difficult question. I mean, after you saw Susan for so long, then you stopped dating her. Why?